The hour of 10:15 having arrived, we'll call the House Tax Committee to order when we have a quorum. We will start out, when we have a quorum, I'll move House File 1590, and then we'll actually be laying it over. We're not voting out of committee, and it's not really for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill because it would be going separately. So that being said, I will have, let's just go with the department kind of describing what the bill is since it's basically their bill. And then I have two people that would like to testify, a Mr. Ward Ines and a Miss Beth Cadoon. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on behalf of 1590 other than names I mentioned, or anyone that has concerns about 1590 other than those that have been mentioned? Okay. Does the department have anything to say about this bill?
Mr. Chair.
Please state your name and who you represent for the record and tell me what my bill does.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I am the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Mr. Chair, these are very good pieces of legislation that you have authored, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Well, first of all, to get the bill in the order the author would like, we don't have a quorum. So when we do have a quorum, I'll be moving the 0139 amendment. At that point, just so that Mr. Cummings will be describing the bill as in the order we want. Okay, so with that, please proceed, sir.
Thank you for the opportunity to present and discuss the 2015 Department of Revenue's policy and technical bills. Mr. Chair, I will be providing some opening remarks, and then our attorneys will be walking through the provisions of the policy and technical bills in the order of the bill in summary. As you mentioned, Mr. Chair, we do have author's amendments we would like to place on the bill. I think we can go over the amendments now, or it may be more appropriate for our attorneys to point out in their testimony what updates from the amendments are being made. Throughout the year, the Department of Revenue notices items in the tax code that could be clarified, updated, or corrected. These ideas are developed, edited, and improved throughout the interim. After development, they are drafted into bills and then begin moving through the legislative process. Mr. Chair, I thank you for carrying all of the provisions in the policy and technical bill. But in order for this to work, it takes the hands of many. Other authors have stepped up to carry various provisions within this package, so they can be heard in the relevant committees. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd also like to thank Representatives Petersburg, Lesch, Torkelson, Loeffler, Loon, and Slocum for assisting in this effort. I also wanted to note that part of our policy and technical bill package is one other bill relating to automatic sale suppression devices, or zappers. That is being carried by Representative Slocum, and that bill is working its way towards taxes. Mr. Chair, we would like to work with you to look over that proposal and see if you think it warrants a hearing before this committee.
Well, to that point, is that something that you're thinking we should possibly, the Slocum bill, that we should, is there really any controversy that should we just amend that on down the road onto this?
Mr. Chair, I think when that bill gets into the hands of this committee, it may be appropriate to have a separate hearing on that bill, and you can consider it for your omnibus tax bill.
Okay, so that's kind of the route you like to, because she has a wonderful bill that I think we should move forward with, but we'll figure that out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So if the tax code, Mr. Chair, is a car, we like to think of the policy and technical bills as a tune-up or an oil change. Usually these are intended to make the tax code work better. These tune-ups are needed on a regular basis to ensure the tax code remains up to date and nimble. But we don't necessarily think of them as maybe changing out parts or putting in a new engine of any kind. It's just a tune-up. Mr. Chair, many people tend to view these provisions in these bills as either policy, having a substantive impact, or technical, conforming to current practice, or a change with no impact. But yet many times it is not black or white. Is usually in grayscale, somewhere in between. In preparing these bills, we need to make a judgment call as to which bill is most appropriate for each provision. If you would have selected another bill placement, we're open to that discussion of which bill this should be placed in. but we prepared two bills rather than one in deference to the past legislature's request. I would like to offer to you all our assistance, Mr. Chair, in improving any of the proposals that are within this. If issues or concerns do come up, we would like the opportunity to work with you, Mr. Chair, or members of this committee, and other partners within the community to make sure that we can improve the provisions and also make sure that we can describe the problem as clearly as possible. Mr. Chair, I want to bring up some examples in this year's bill where the department is working with outside groups to better explain the provisions and to develop better possible language to meet the needs of impacted Minnesotans where possible. First, the department has a provision related to the landlord's certification of rent paid. Mr. Littlejenquist from the Minnesota Multi-Housing Association reached out to express some hesitancy about what this provision may mean for his members. Terry Steenblock, our Assistant Commissioner for Individual Taxes, will be meeting with members of that trade association this afternoon to listen to their concerns and to see how the language can be improved. Second, Ms. Cadoon from the Minnesota Chamber and Ms. Larson from the Business Partnership had suggested some language to clarify the date of commissioner's orders, which will be described later in testimony, Mr. Chair. We just received their language just a few days ago, and we are reviewing it. We will be continuing to work with them on this, and we'll report back to the committee on that progress, Mr. Chair. Finally, you, Mr. Chair, have asked us to work with Mr. Innes on the clarification relating to the local lodging taxes. We look forward to discussing this provision with Mr. Innes to better understand his concerns. So with that, Mr. Chair, we would like to turn it I would like to turn it over to our attorneys within the department to walk through the bills, and they will be here as a resource to this committee. And again, Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity to present these bills today.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. And with that, we do have a quorum, so I'll officially call the House Tax Committee to order. I will, Representative Simonson moves the minutes of March 18th, 2015. Any additions or corrections? Seeing or hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Simonson. Okay, members, I will move House File 1590. I will now move the A15-0139 amendment to get the bill in the order the author would like. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Okay, again, members, this is our technical and basically housekeeping bills that we have here today. And as you know, chairs in the past have been very clear that, and I'm going to follow the tradition, that these bills are not to be to get out of this committee with controversial provisions in them. If we have objections to certain provisions, and Mr. Cummings, I want to thank the department for working with us. We've noticed a few things. I remember one time on a technical bill I carried, I had to strip the Viking Stadium out of it. I think you had that, didn't you? So we didn't want things like that in there. No, maybe that wasn't in that one. But the point, members, is that we want this to be the kind of the non-controversial, help the department out. And I really appreciate your analogy of a car and an oil change, because I had a 1984 S10 Blazer, and I was really busy for some months, and I blew the engine up, and then I looked.
That's our policy and technical bill, Mr. Chair.
Awesome. And so I had 17,582 miles on. I blew the engine up, and so I learned the importance of every 3,000 miles. So these bills are kind of the 3,000-mile type things. But I always look at the bright and the positive side. I just calculated how many oil changes I saved. So you got to look at the bright side. So with that being said, please state... Back then in 84, it was $895.
Isn't that great?
And I saved how much in oil changes?
Was that in the seats? $50.
That was a nice little S10 Blazer.
Well, wasn't very expensive.
So with that, if you could please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Sure. Thank you, members. Mr. Chair, my name is Mark Peterson. I'm an attorney with the Department of Revenue. I will go over Article 1.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you.
And members, this is as amended, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Mr. Chair. Section 1 removes a reference that's been in law since the mid-1990s that allowed individual income tax filers to file by telephone. It was an option allowed by the Internal Revenue Service in the 1990s. Minnesota piggybacked on that. We never have had any separate telephone filings. The IRS gave it up in 2005. There hasn't been any, and there will, I can't imagine, ever be any more telephone filings of individual income tax, so we're repealing that language. Section 2 eliminates an annual withholding tax reconciliation. There was a time when everything was in paper and employers would file quarterly returns, and at the end of the year they would have to file another piece of paper that balanced the quarterly returns with the amount that they paid for the at the end of the year. With the electronic records now, the department can more efficiently do it and does it better doing it electronically. There's no longer a need for this reconciliation to be filed, so we're recommending it be repealed. Sections 3, 4, 5, and 9 repeal references to a difference in the way that certain kinds of pollution control facilities were depreciated for property that was placed in service back before 1987, when Minnesota didn't fully conform to federal depreciation schedules. All of this had been, if there was anybody in Minnesota that's been using it over the last years, the last year they really could have used this would have been 2012. So we're recommending now, we've waited a couple extra years to come forward to repeal that from the law. Section 6 deals with the TANF appropriations to pay working family credit refunds. And this clarifies that the TANF grant money is used only to pay the portion of the refunds attributable to law changes that were enacted in 2000. It doesn't do anything as it relates to future payments, and I know there's proposals to do something or not do something going forward. This only fixes it and makes it clear that the changes, enhancements to the working family credit last year, those enhancements were not to come from the TANF grant money, but instead from the work from the general fund. Section 7 changes changes a definition of long-term care insurance that's eligible for the long-term insurance premiums tax. In defining the eligibility for the credit, it was made with reference to policies that are allowed as an itemized deduction, notwithstanding the fact that in order to get an itemized deduction at all, your deductions have to be more than 7.5% of your total adjusted gross income. That 7.5% threshold, in order to be able to change, to be able to deduct your itemized deduction, has been changed by Congress a few years ago to a 10% limitation. This is just a definitional change to make sure that, I want to make some rationality to what we're talking about here. It's just a definitional thing, does not affect anybody's ability to take an itemized deduction or to take this credit. Section 8 removes a reference in the alternative minimum tax that was created when there was inflation adjustment during 2007, when there was a change in updating. There was language that said how we were supposed to do it under the old law versus the new law. The old law is now going back to 2008. We don't need it anymore. We're recommending repealing it. Section 10 removes the cross-reference in a credit, in a state tax credit. Last year, the credit was moved from Section 291.03 to 290.031, but in the process, a reference to the tax paid under this section was inadvertently not changed. This corrects that. And Section 11 repeals a rule dealing with what construction contractors have to follow in order to demonstrate compliance with income tax withholding requirements, obligations, before they can receive final payment under contracts with the state or local government. The rule was promulgated early 1960s. It mainly restates the law, and we will administer the law without any real changes. This duplicates the law, makes references to wrong forms, obsolete forms, and we recommend repeal. That's Article 1.
Okay, I think what we'll do, members, is we'll stop for member questions after each article. Are we going to have a different person for each article?
Sometimes.
Pretty much?
Yes.
Okay, sometimes. Okay, so questions from, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on behalf of or with concerns on Article 1? Okay, then we'll go to member questions. Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is not really a question, but regarding Section 10 on line 14.12, I think it's valuable to put on the record again just an explanation of what it is that we're doing here, because we're not changing current policy, and I think it just bears repeating and hearing from the department exactly what we're doing here with this particular language.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simonson, that's exactly correct. Last year there was just an omission in the cross-reference to the tax, where the tax is imposed. The tax is and always has been imposed under 291.03. When this was removed, it was formerly in that section, so when it was recodified into a different section, it no longer made any sense, so this is just correcting that omission. It's not changing any policy, just effectuating the clear intent of last year's legislation.
Yeah, I noticed that. Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make sure we got that clarified.
Okay, thank you, sir. On Article 1 for Mr. Peterson, questions from members. Okay, let's go to Article 2, please. Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
My name is Susan Barry from the Minnesota Department of Revenue.
How do you spell your last name?
Barry is B-A-R-R-Y.
Oh, okay. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. The first section of this Article 2, the Sales and Use Tax article, amends the section that to clarify that the amount to be deposited in the state airports fund from the sales tax that's collected on the sale or purchase of an aircraft is limited to the revenue that's generated under another section, which would impose the 6.5% rate. So the amount that goes into the state airports fund is just the 6.5%. The additional 0.375% will be deposited into the Heritage Fund per the Minnesota Constitution. The second section in the bill has been deleted now per the amendment. That will be carried in another bill. And then the last section in this bill, which is now would now be Section 2, is the local lodging tax provision. So under this also has been amended so that instead of proposing a subdivision 1A to 469190, the local lodging tax provision, this proposes to amend subdivision 1 that authorizes cities and towns to impose a lodging tax. So it clarifies that whether authorized under a general or a special law, the lodging tax will apply to the full price or compensation paid for access to short-term lodging. It makes it explicit and it confirms the original intent that this tax applies to all lodging-related services, including accommodation intermediary services. And that's the Article 2.
Okay, I believe that's one where there's some question, that article, which we'll get to later. Questions for Ms. Barry. And Ms. Barry, what was your first name again?
Susan.
Susan, thank you. Okay, any questions from members for Ms. Barry? Anyone from the audience who should testify for Article 2 or with concerns thereof, other than the lodging tax thing, which we'll get to later? Any questions for members? Thank you very much, Ms. Barry. Item next, we'll go to Article 3. You get that one too?
Mr. Chair, I have Article 3 as well, special taxes.
Please proceed.
Sections 1, 2, and 6 of the bill regarding township mutual insurance companies, it amends a provision in the insurance tax provision, in the fire state 8 provision, and also in the income tax provision to replace the term town and farmers mutual insurance companies with the current term township mutual insurance companies. The next section is Section 3. It's amending a petroleum products definition so to include a reference to the biobutanol subdivision. Recently, there was a definition put in for biobutanol, but this reference was not put into the petroleum products definition, and so it was just an oversight, and that needs to happen. Section 4, regarding the biobutanol blends, it amends to clarify that these blends are taxable as gasoline. This is similar to the treatment of ethanol. Once blended with gasoline, it's taxable. Currently, there are no such blends in the state, but we are expecting that they will be coming. Section 5 in the Solid Waste Management Tax Chapter, for the recyclable materials and also source-separated compostable materials, it does two things. First of all, it clarifies the exemption from the solid waste management tax for recycling materials, which is currently available if the price for handling the materials is separately itemized, clarifies that this means separately itemized on the bill to the generator of the waste. That way they are aware of what they're paying for the recycling and the fact that it is exempt from this tax. The second thing it does is to correct terminology regarding the exemption for source-separated compostable materials. And this is consistent with the terms that are used in Chapter 115A concerning, you know, this is one of the Pollution Control Agency's chapters and the related rules. Section 7 and 8, the firefighter relief surcharge payments, it amends a section in the insurance tax chapter to clarify that it's the Commissioner of Revenue and not the Commissioner of Management and Budget that determines the amount of payment for the firefighter relief surcharge for cities of the first class. The department has been making these payouts since 2003. Section 9 and Section 10 are both regarding occupation tax. One thing that they do is to correct a lot of cross-referencings that are done according to the renumbering that were done in Article 1, which we've already gone over for some cross-referencing in Chapter 290. The other thing it does in Section 10 is that it amends 298.01, Subdivision 4C, to delete a reference to an obsolete net operating loss provision. That repealed provision applies to these tax periods for which net operating loss carryover is no longer available. And that's the article.
Ms. Berry, can you say that last thing again?
Yes. In Minnesota Statutes 298.01, Subdivision 4C, we're deleting a reference to an obsolete net operating loss provision. And it's obsolete because it's been repealed. So the repealed provision had applied to tax periods for which the net operating loss carryover is no longer available.
At this point.
But it is a cross-reference to a repealed provision, Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
On Ms. Berry, on pages 20 and 21, I understand you're getting rid of Commissioner Management Budget. Should we be putting revenue in there, or is it by default because this is the tax stuff that it's automatically revenue?
Mr. Chair, it is by default Commissioner of Revenue.
Revenue. Yes. Okay, very good. Very good. Any questions for members on Article 3 for Ms. Berry? Anyone from the audience wish to testify in support of or with questions on 3? Okay, item next, Article 4. Thank you, Ms. Berry. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Kyle Gustafson, Gustafson. I'm an attorney with the Department of Revenue, and I'll be doing the overview for Article 4 related to property tax.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sections 1, 3, and 4 clarify that all transportation pipelines are subject to assessment and taxation without regard to the materials that are flowing through those pipelines. Section 2 removes an obsolete reference to the lead hazard market value reduction. That was something that was repealed in 2013. Section 5 clarifies that the statutes dealing with local boards of appeal and equalization are indeed specific to local boards versus county boards, just to make that crystal clear. Section 6 extends the deadline from December 1st to February 1st for county boards of appeal and equalization to certify that they have a trained member on the board in order to be eligible to hold the regular board meetings. Section 7 clarifies that taxing authorities need only announce the time and place of their regularly scheduled meetings for budget and levy discussions if they have such a meeting. Section 8 modernizes language that is used in describing the procedures for taxing districts to sell tax forfeited land. Section 9 clarifies that when a governmental subdivision has tax forfeited land that are received for free with conditional use deed, and then that entity wishes to outright purchase it free and clear of that conditional use deed for market value, that prior to the department issuing a new state deed, that governmental entity must first reconvey it to the state before there's a new deed issued. Sections 10 and 11 restore an exemption for personal property of an electrical generating facility that was inadvertently repealed last year during the unsession process. And Section 12 in the repealer addresses two provisions. The first repeals a section in the Green Acre statute that applied to enforcement actions related to cross-compliance checks with agricultural, chemical, and water quality statutes that were effective for 2009 to 2013, and therefore that provision is obsolete. And then the next section in the repealer removes an obsolete provision related to the one-year notice of expiration of redemption on properties bid in for the state through the forfeiture process prior to 1935. And, Mr. Chair, that concludes Article 4.
Anyone in the audience wish to testify on behalf of or with concerns on Article 4? Questions for members on Article 4? You know, this is kind of like watching paint dry, so I think this is, I mean, it's a page turner, I understand, but or maybe watching corn grow, but the point is that's what this bill is for. If there's anything that members see that jumps out at them that they have concerns about, that's what we're here for today. So we want it to be like watching paint dry. Okay, item next, who has Article 5? Thank you, Mr. Gustafson. And not that that wasn't very interesting. I didn't, you know, it was extremely exciting. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
My name is Joan Tuich. It's spelled T-U-J-E-T-S-C-H, and I represent the Department of Revenue. And I'll be going over Article 5 of the technical bill.
T-J-E-T-S-C-H?
T-U-J-E-T-S-C-H.
How did you say that again?
Tuich.
Tuich.
Tuich, correct.
Tuich. Okay, Tuich. Okay.
Okay.
Please proceed on Article 5.
Section 1 clarifies how income is calculated for purposes of determining whether a refund can be intercepted to pay a debt for medical care. Under the statute, a refund cannot be applied to medical care debts if the person's income was below certain income levels at the time that they received the care. Currently, the statute is unclear on how the income of a spouse is treated and whether the spouse is a dependent. This proposal clarifies that the income of the spouse is included in the calculation and that the spouse is considered a dependent. Additionally, the threshold income amounts are updated to current amounts, and lines 119 through 122 of the amendment just insert the proper years into the inflation adjustment for future years. Section 2 clarifies that if a taxpayer files both an administrative appeal for an order of the commissioner and also files a tax court appeal for the same order, then the administrative appeal is dismissed and the commissioner is not required to make a determination on that appeal. And finally, Section 3 clarifies that for purposes of the tax clearance program, a licensing authority may accept a federal individual taxpayer identification number in addition to Social Security numbers and Minnesota business identification numbers. And that concludes Article 5.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions for the witness? Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question will revolve around lines 35.28. through 31, and I understand to the testifier, what I heard you say was that this provides the clarification that the spousal income will be considered along with the individuals as part of a clarification, but I'm curious if we're clarifying what has been the history of the department's position on this, and has it ever been challenged? In other words, why are we offering a clarification?
Ms. Tuich?
Yes, this has been the department's position on this. And originally, this language was included by cross-reference in the statute in 1984. it was tied to the low-income credit, which was later repealed. And then for a couple of years, it was referenced to the law of that section. And over the years, that part just slipped out, and it didn't come to our attention until someone called and asked us how to interpret it. But this is how it's always been interpreted, and how I think the public has interpreted it.
And Mr. Chair, follow-up.
Representative Simonson.
So there's not been a challenge from somebody in the public that perhaps didn't want their spousal income to be included in this calculation?
No.
Ms. Jewich?
Mr. Chair, Representative, no, there has not been.
Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that's one of those areas that I wonder about, but if there's no controversy and no concern from other members.
Okay, Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is just the section right above it. What legislation, I think I missed it, what legislation or what year was those amounts changed that we're doing the technical change?
Ms. Stewich.
Mr. Chair, Representative, could you repeat the question?
Representative
yes.
Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On lines 3522 through 35.27, we have changes of the amounts that are there. And so I just assumed that those were clarified in some other statute, and I was just curious as to when and what statutes those were changed.
These are the,
Switch.
Mr. Chair, Representative, these are the amounts for 2014. Every year there's an adjustment made, and those numbers increase, and that's what paragraph C is the adjustment. So that's the calculation that's used. And those numbers that have been replaced are the current numbers for 2014.
Thanks for that clarification.
Representative Petersburg. Okay. Other members, Representative Chair Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Section 2, the dismissal of administrative appeal. Would you explain why that change is needed?
Ms. Tuich.
Yes. I'll defer to my colleague on that one.
We're calling a friend here.
Mr. Chair, when a taxpayer files both an administrative appeal and a tax court appeal, they can only, they can only do one course of that appeal. So, we're assuming that, and we always have assumed that when there's appeal pending at the department and then they go to tax court, that the tax court is the jurisdiction in which they would like their appeal heard. So that has been the position of the department, and so we're just making that clear in statute.
You state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Good morning. My name is Jacob Smith. I am an attorney for the Department of Revenue.
Welcome, Mr. Smith, to the...
So I guess, Mr. Questions. Chair, my concern was, has this not been clear to the taxpayers previous to your suggesting this change?
Mr. Smith?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. It was not clear in statute, and this is really as a clarification for the department's current position.
Chair Erickson.
So, Mr. Chair, and to whomever, have we had this issue occurring repeatedly for our taxpayers?
Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. over the past year, this has been an increasing problem where there have been simultaneous appeals within the Department of Revenue, but also an appeal to tax court, and this is to remedy that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Smith. Any other questions for Mr. Smith or Ms. Tuich? Okay, that wraps up.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Simonson.
I apologize, but I have one further question, and maybe for Mr. Michael. But going back to this very same issue again, do we have any other place in Minnesota law where we wouldn't consider spousal income as part of a calculation that you can think of?
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simonson, I'm having a hard time thinking. Basically, in the income tax system, you can almost always elect for a married couple to file separately. And if you file separately, then the tax computations are, based only on each spouse's income separately. But usually there's a huge disincentive to do that because there's a number of provisions that essentially don't give you half the benefit that you would get if you were married filing jointly, but in some cases almost zero out or don't allow you to claim the benefit. And in other cases, that you know, basically there's a huge disincentive to file separate in the income tax system as opposed to married joint. I think in the property tax refund area that if you have, in that case it has to, you would have to be married, if it's a true married couple, they have to include the income of both spouses if they reside in the household. I can't think of any instance for sort of a means-tested kind of program where you can sort of ignore the spouse's income. You know, and this basically, this provision, what we're talking about here is people who have debts typically owed because of medical assistance and or other public assistance programs that medical providers are trying to recover through the, you know, through revenue recapture. This is a revenue recapture feature. And, you know, so I think in most of these instances it would be a case where the spousal income, you know, should be taken into account because it's the, you know, the income of the married couple that's actually living together. But
And thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Michael. And Mr. Chair, forgive me, I missed the first minute, but were you laying this over or were you passing this on?
We're going to be laying it over.
Okay, well, that'll give me some time to do some more follow-up on it. I appreciate it.
You will retain the bill.
Thank you.
Any other questions for members or any comments from House Research, Ms. Dalton or Joel Michael, Mr. Michael on these? Okay. Okay, so with that, we'll go to the next bill, but we will be taking testimony from some folks, and they can refer which bill they're interested in right now. So I will, at this point, lay House File 1590 over, and not for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill because these would be going separately. I will now move House File 1589, and we have an amendment, A15-0138. To get the bill in the shape the author like, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, members. Okay, we now have House File 1589 as amended before the committee. And we'll kind of, I think, go through the same routine here, and then we'll be asking for public testimony. Of course, we'll have questions from members. Okay, Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Peterson.
I didn't even write it down. I'm amazed at myself. Okay, Peterson. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Maybe Chair. I'll go through. I'll go through Article 1.
There's an 80s song in there somewhere. Mr. Peterson, 2-1589 as amended, Article 1.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sections 1 and 4 are related. Under current law, a professional income tax, individual income tax filer who reasonably expects to prepare more than 10 returns during the tax filing season is required to submit all returns to the Department of Revenue electronically. There's a $5 fee for each return that the preparer does not file electronically. They can get out of the fee if the taxpayer individual that they're preparing the return for indicates on the return that they do not check a box saying, I do not want to have my return filed electronically. The proposal here is to make that same law apply to professionals who are preparing corporate, partnership, and fiduciary returns. Additionally, law currently requires that individual income tax preparers submit a identification number, their tax identification number on their return as they prepare it, $50 penalty for not including their ID number on the return. We're proposing that make that also apply to professionals who prepare corporate, partnership, trust, and S-corp returns. Section 2 amends the law to allow the Commissioner of Revenue to determine the content, form, and manner in which W-2s are submitted to the Commissioner. Effective for W-2 is required to be submitted after December 31 of 2015. Section 3 amends the law relating to the taxation of and the reporting to the Department of Revenue of non-Minnesota municipal bond interest, which is taxable to Minnesota. Under current law, if you have a taxpayer has money invested in a bond fund, the bond fund is required to send to the Department of Revenue each year a statement indicating how much of that bond dividend was from non-Minnesota issued bonds. What this proposal does is two things. One is that it would require the same sort of reporting if there's interest that is received directly by a nominee. So if a brokerage account is set up and has bonds that are issued by the state of Iowa or the state of California or some water district in New York, the brokerage account company typically would get that money in their account as a nominee. They then tell the taxpayer at the end of the year anyways how much money they've got from all these different sources, all these different bonds. The requirement would be that they'd have to notify the Department of Revenue of the non-Minnesota municipal bond interest. The same for if you hold a bond fund through a brokerage account, the brokerage company would be required to submit that information to the Department of Revenue. Effective for returns required to be filed after December 31 of 15.
Would that be on, Mr. Peterson, would that be on like a 1099-B? Would they be filing that on?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if they're doing it on a 1099-B or if it's just one of those attachments that you get from the brokerage on your brokerage statement at the end of the year. I don't know if they put it on a 1099-B or not. It's not really subject to federal tax, so the IRS generally doesn't. Correct.
Mr. Peter, yeah.
Correct. Okay. But I do think they have to report it. I do think it's on a 1099-B, but I can check for
you. Okay. Please proceed, sir.
Yeah. Next section would give the commissioner the authority to require owners and managing agents of residential rental property to submit to the commissioner in a form manner prescribed by the commissioner a copy of each CRP that they have furnished to a renter. If required, that would have to be submitted to the commissioner by February 1 of the year after the rent was paid. This is a provision that Mr. Cummings in his presentation said we're meeting with affected parties later this afternoon to continue working on this provision. And Section 6 is an estate tax provision that deals with qualified farm property exemption that would say that the exemption is not lost if a portion of the property is reclassified from Class 2A to Class 4B during the three-year holding period. That provision is effective for states of Acedenstein after June 30 of 2011, which means that it pushes back to the original effective date of the qualified farm property exemption.
Okay, so on 6.21, is that 4B? You have 4BB?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, yes. So if I said 4B, I was wrong.
It's 4BBB,
BBB. Yes. Okay. Thank you.
That's Article 1?
That's Article 1, yes, Mr. Chair.
Anyone from the audience would testify in support of or with concerns on Article 1? Questions for members on Article 1? Okay, please proceed. Article 2. Welcome back, Ms. Berry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Article 2, special taxes. First two sections are Minnesota Care tax related. The first section will amend Chapter 289A of the administrative chapter for the department to clarify that a person that omits from the Minnesota Care tax return an amount of tax that's 25% higher than the amount reported may be assessed within 6.5 years after the due date of the return or the date the return was filed, whichever is later. And so this makes it consistent with other taxes. Section 2 regarding the pharmacy refund. The pharmacy refund applies to pharmacies that purchase legend drugs from wholesalers subject to the wholesale drug distributor tax. Very few qualify for this refund, but what this provision does is to amend the Minnesota Care Tax Chapter to provide that the request for the refund has to be filed on an annual return by March 15th of the year, following the year in which the drugs were delivered outside of Minnesota. This March 15th date is consistent with all other Minnesota Care Tax returns. Section 3 and 4 are petroleum tax provisions. Section 3 on bulk storage or bulk storage facilities. This term is used throughout the petroleum tax chapter, but it has never been defined. And so this defines what that is. We arrived at this definition by reviewing other state laws that have this definition for petroleum and after consultation with the petroleum industry. Section 5, the motor fuel definition. This is updating this definition so that it also refers to gaseous forms of fuels, such as the CNG, the compressed natural gas, also the LP gas. All of this will be captured under the definition of the motor fuel definition. And then finally, Section 5, gambling taxes. For untaxed gambling product, it amends this particular section to provide that there is a tax return filing requirement for untaxed gambling. And it also provides the authority to tax all forms of gambling that are illegal under the criminal code in Chapter 609. And as well, it provides disclosure provisions. And that's Article 2.
Ms. Brake, could you talk a little bit more about what we're doing on the gambling part here? That I thought you said illegal gambling?
Yes, Mr. Chair. As I said, it does two things. One is that it provides a tax return filing requirement for the untaxed gambling, you know, whether the gambling is lawful gambling or illegal gambling. Currently, there is not a requirement for the tax return filing.
If they're doing illegal gambling, are they probably not filing tax returns?
Mr. Chair, that's similar to the in the gambling tax law, we have sports bookmaking, which is subject to tax. And similar to in our drug tax chapter on the tax on marijuana and other products, those things are also illegal, but you know there are tax return filing requirements.
So this really? How do you do that?
Yeah,
that's my question.
And that, Mr. Chair, that's why we have the disclosure provisions, that the department is not allowed to disclose the fact that someone is filing a return. They can do it anonymously, but they have with we are not allowed to contact law enforcement to let them know that this is happening. So it's the same thing with the sports bookmaking.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Berry, how many returns do you get a year saying I'm gambling illegally? Here's right. My $25,000 tax check.
Mr. Chair, this is doing two things. One is the tax return filing requirement. The other thing it's doing is that it's also providing authority to tax all forms of illegal gambling. So that is not in there right now. Right now, we are only allowed to tax the lawful gambling, but there's not a return requirement for that. What I'm pointing out is that if we're also making illegal gambling subject to tax, then that return requirement would apply to them as well as the lawful gambling.
Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair and members, typically there are many cases in which they are not filing returns, as you suspect, Mr. Chair. And these are opportunities in those cases in which criminal activity is taking place for additional charges to be placed upon those individuals, whether that deals with drugs or whether that deals with illegal forms of gambling. So the tax code is another element in which a charge might take place.
So you...
That is obviously what Ms. Berry was talking about, was clarifying the way in which the current law is administered. But that, I think you were asking about sort of the underlying parts of some of those intentions behind those statutes.
So I'm gambling illegally, and I, of course, file my tax return because it's my civic duty. What do you do with that return? You said you can't notify law enforcement. Why not?
Mr. Chair, because there's a disclosure provision written into the law that would not allow us to do that. On page 9, it says that notwithstanding any law to the contrary, neither the commissioner nor a public employee may reveal facts contained in the tax return filed with the commissioner. Nor can any information contained in the report or return be used against the tax obligor in any criminal proceedings, unless, of course, it's independently obtained. I mean, if law enforcement were to find out that someone is, doing illegal betting, something like that, then that information could be used, of course, in the proceeding, but not coming from the Department of Revenue. So as long as the disclosure provision is in there, we would not be allowed to.
Are you trying to increase the number of returns filed by illegal gamblers? Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair, one of the things that was brought up, especially as it relates to illegal gambling, when we receive some notification in which this activity is happening and taxes has not been paid, mm-hmm. One of the things that are in here is to provide a tax filing requirement that has a due date. We need to be able to assess a tax from a certain date, a date in which the return was not filed. So typically these returns are not filed, right? It is not the norm that these are filed. But when the tax is finally assessed and then penalties and interest are assessed on that, we do need a date to go back to start assessing those penalties and interest and tax. And that is why it's helpful for us to insert a due date, which is one of the elements of this bill.
I guess it begs the question, if I'm gambling illegally, am I really going to file a return?
No.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Cummings?
Typically, you know that may not be the case, but when you are caught illegal gambling, then when the charges are assessed, whether they are assessed through the Gambling Control Board or Public Safety or whatever, then there are also charges that come along with not paying your taxes so many times that those charges can be stacked on one another.
Representative Garofalo.
Mr. Chairman, I didn't realize this provision was in this bill. I just want to make sure. I sometimes joke on social media about having sports gambling behavior on the Internet. I just want to assure the department I'm not really doing that. In case there's any enforcers, the department or anything.
Chair Garofalo, just make sure you file a return. Chair Drazkowski, then Swedzinski.
Mr. Chair, how do we amend the title to call this the Garofalo provision?
We're the tax committee. We can do whatever we want. The gentleman from Lyon.
Thank you. And my guess is this probably happened in the 1930s or something like that with Representative Al Capone or whatnot. But kind of just a general question. So you don't reveal it by your own, but if there's a warrant that would be placed, it could be captured as evidence then. So there would have to be criminal proceedings in order to get that information through the Department of Revenue that you would not offer it is what they're saying, I think.
Ms. Berry?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it could happen that way, but also we could get a tip, for example, that some illegal gambling was going on. And we could follow up on that. Or perhaps there was some business who was doing some things legal and illegal, and we audited them and we find out about the illegal activities as well. We do have a very nice tip line.
Ms. Bear, are there finder's fees for turning people?
Mr. Chair, no, Mr. Chair.
The
I see an amendment coming.
The gratitude of a grateful department, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Where am I? Gentleman from Lyon. Anyone else for questions on this? Mr. Cummings, you and I are going to talk more about this one. Chair Earhart.
Point of information, Mr. Chairman. I see a man with a camera up there and back, and we usually ask that they identify themselves if it's CCO or KSDP or whatever, I would like the person up there to identify who he represents.
Okay, sir. Could you please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir?
My name is Emilio Valiente. I work for Alliance Preference.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Yeah, thank you.
Oh, Chair Earhart?
Thank you.
Okay. Item next, I hope. Article 3. Thank you, Ms. Berry. I'm intrigued. You know, this isn't quite so boring as I thought. That was interesting. Mr. Gustafson, welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Again, my name is Kyle Gustafson. I'm an attorney with the Department of Revenue. I'll be addressing Article 3 related to property tax.
Make it more fun.
Mr. Chair, members, that's a high order. Section 1 provides that certain data related to income-producing property that is already classified as private or non-public data, one is collected by counties or other political subdivisions, will also be deemed to be private or non-public when collected by the state. The next set of sections deal with air flight property tax. Section 2 defines air commerce to specifically include airline companies that make three or more flights in, out, or within Minnesota during a calendar year. Section 3.
Question. Oh, okay. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, that caught my attention earlier. Is that just the commercial airline with the, or does that include private pilots? And I don't mean the Stearmans or Super Cubs, but like the Flying Cloud Airports, who has more private.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I'm going to defer to Ms. Sims.
Okay. Well, please, you can stay down there with me here too, so you can finish here.
Good morning. My name is Harriet Sims, and I'm an attorney with the Department of Revenue.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Sims.
Later on in the discussion, we will see a lot of other definitions. Essentially, in order to be taxable, the entity has to be in the business of air commerce, and what is taxed is the flight property, and so there are particular parameters of exactly what kind of aircraft would be taxed. So this would include, it would certainly include commercial airlines. It would not include somebody who just owns a plane and might, take people on flights. But they would have to be in the business of air commerce, and then we define that. The purpose of this is not so much to change how we are currently taxing it, but if you read the statute that exists, a lot of the definitions are circular. Some of them are out, and some of them are out of date. So we're fixing that. And we are also defining what is flight property and making it clear that that is what we are taxing. So if something falls out of the definition of flight property, that's not taxed. They still file a report with us to tell us what the flight property is, but we wouldn't tax anything that doesn't fall within that definition.
McDonald.
Thank you, and I admit I'm ignorant on the issue. Why does the Department of Revenue need to know this data?
I'm
Sims.
Sorry?
Representative McDonald.
Is this regarding Sim? Section 1? Or?
Well, this regards to the, thank you, Mr. Chair, this regards to the answer that you gave me as to the question that I asked. Why does the Department of Revenue, and I claim ignorance, I'll tell you that. But why does the Department of Revenue need to know this information?
Ms. Sims?
Chairman, Representative, if you're referring to why do we need to know whether the companies make three or more flights in or out of Minnesota?
Representative McDonald?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay. Yes.
That is because that is part of the definition of air commerce. So, for instance, if airline company makes one or two flights into in or out of Minnesota, they would not fit the definition of air commerce. So that would not be taxable. We wouldn't know that, you know, unless we got some information from them as to how many flights they were making.
Mr. McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, now I am informed, so thank you.
Okay, Mr. Gustafson, if you could please continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Continuing along that line, Section 3 defines flight property such that it does not include aircraft with a maximum takeoff weight of less than 30,000 pounds, but rather this would provide a, this provision provides a definition of maximum takeoff weight rather than using the existing term in statute of gross weight. Maximum takeoff weight is a standardized aviation term used in the industry, and we're just picking that up in Section 3. Section 4 defines person consistent with that definition that is used in Chapter 270C to make the definition consistent here with the definition used in other taxes administered by the commissioner. Section 5 defines intermittent or irregularly timed flights to mean flights in which departures and arrivals are negotiated between the airline and the customer, and this also includes charter flights. Section 6 removes the reference to planes with a gross weight of less than 30,000 pounds because in Section 3 we are picking up that maximum takeoff weight definition. I'll be jumping back to Section 7 in 1 minute, but first in Section 8, this provides that if an airline company does not file its annual report with the commissioner may file a report based on the information that is available and obtainable to the commissioner, and also may then issue a notice of net tax capacity. Going back to Section 7 and then also Section 10, these provisions clarify language that an airline company must file reports unless the commissioner determines that the airline company is exempt. It also provides that the commissioner may prescribe the content, format, and manner of both air flight as well as railroad property tax reports. It also adds a cross-reference to the definition of electronic signature in Chapter 270C. Section 9 allows the State Board of Equalization to issue orders to county assessors to reassess all or part of a parcel in a county if the board determines that property has been under or overvalued and the assessment is deemed to be grossly unfair or inequitable. Section 11 eliminates the requirement that county boards of appeal and equalization file a printed or typewritten copy of its minutes with the department. This doesn't have any effect on those boards to keep the minutes. It simply removes the need for them to send it to us. Section 12 provides that one of the criteria for determining whether to combine the nameplate capacity of wind energy conversion systems is whether the systems were constructed within the same 12-month period versus in the same calendar year. Section 13 moves the date for filing annual reports for a wind energy conversion system from February 1st to January 15th. And Section 14 allows the commissioner to grant a 15-day extension for someone to file a wind energy production tax report. These past three sections, 12 through 14, bring the wind energy tax provisions into compliance and consistent with the solar energy production tax provisions that are in statute. Sections 15 and 16 allows the county assessor to require local assessors to enter construction and valuation data into the records as directed by the county assessor. Section 17 provides that if a county or city assessor fails to timely mail valuation notices to taxpayers, that the assessor must first mail an additional valuation notice and hold a supplemental local board of appeal and equalization meeting. Section 18 provides a new subdivision, providing that if a utility company does not file a report with the commissioner may file a report based on information available or obtainable by the commissioner. Also provides that an extension for filing a report by a utility pipeline company may not exceed 15 days, and it also provides conforming language in that statute to take into account the new proposed subdivision. Section 19 provides that utility and railroad company appeals to the Minnesota Tax Court must be filed within the time period that's established in the tax court's statutes in Chapter 271. This is 60 days from the date of the order, or an additional 30 days after that if the appellant seeks an extension. Section 20 makes various changes in how utilities and railroads may appeal their valuations. It lays out the timeline for filing a written appeal, as well as the time period in which the department must hold an appeals conference and get out its determination after that appeals conference. This section also specifies what information must be included in such an administrative appeal. Section 21 provides that the commissioner may settle appeals of utility and railroad valuations if it is in the best interest of the state. Section 22 clarifies that if a taxpayer files an administrative appeal, and this being a railroad or utility company, and also files such an appeal with tax court, that the administrative appeal will be dismissed and the commissioner would not need to make a determination on that, and instead the tax court case would go forward. Section 23 provides that county boards of appeal and equalization may not make a change of value to benefit a property owner if the owner has denied the assessor access to the property. This would make the county board's review authority consistent with the prohibition of local boards from making a value reduction where the assessor has been denied access. Section 24 removes the requirement that towns and communities receiving tax night aid file a property tax levy report. These types of communities are no longer or would not be subject to levy limits as they're not defined as a local governmental unit if this body were to turn levy limits back on. Section 25 clarifies that appeals evaluation notices may be filed with the tax court prior to May 1st of the taxes payable year only if those evaluation notices are sent by county assessors versus the state, and therefore this time period to appeal would not apply to state-assessed property with orders coming from the commissioner.
Section Mr. Gustafson, normally I'd just have you go through the rest of the article. This is kind of a long one. Chair Draskowski has a question, so we want to get to that right now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gustafson, Section 23, can you go through that again? Apparently, if we don't let the assessor in, it's used against us somehow. Can you tell us more about that?
Mr. Gustafson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, as I mentioned, currently a local board is already prohibited from making a valuation reduction when an assessor had gone to a property and the property owner was there, and when the assessor asked to come inside and take a look for valuation purposes, the owner declined to allow the assessor in to inspect the property. What this would do is create the same prohibition on a county board for making that type of reduction when the assessor was not allowed to go in and take a look of any improvements that have been made on the property. So it would make it consistent between local boards and the county boards.
Chair Draskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Gustafson, and I understand, you know, you want to have them the same. So does this apply when the valuation is lowered in the same way that when it's raised?
Mr. Gustafson?
Mr. Chair, Representative, this would only apply if the property owner is coming in asking for a reduction in the assessed value.
Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Gustafson, I'll continue to think and ask questions about this later.
Please continue, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Section 26 provides that forest management plans required under the SFIA must be registered with the DNR. It also provides that if land is enrolled in certain programs such as Reinvest in Minnesota, various state and federal programs, A Preserves program, Green Acres, that if that land is enrolled in one of those programs, the entire parcel that contains the acres that are enrolled are not eligible for the SFIA program. The section also clarifies that land classified as 2C managed forest land cannot be enrolled in the SFIA program. This is a technical clarification because 2C land is already defined as property that is not enrolled in that program, in the SFIA program. Section 27 requires that upon request from the Department of Revenue that DNR must annually verify the claimants that claimants under the SFIA program have current forest management plans on file with the DNR. Section 28 requires that cities receiving aid register an official email address with the Department of Revenue. Section 29 and 30 both address the aquatic invasive species prevention aid. Section 29 requires that the Commissioner of Natural Resources certify the number of watercraft launches and watercraft trailer parking spaces in each county for the purpose of administering that aid. And Section 30...
Mr. Gustafson, hasn't that already been done?
Mr. Chair, the first payments already have been made. That is correct.
So... Okay, go ahead, please.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, they have been made, and they have been made with lists from the DNR. And so we are just clearly stating in statute where this list is to come from. Now, one of the things that we received after this aid did go out is we received local units of government saying, well, we got a couple more boat launches than what the DNR says, or we got a couple more parking spots, right? Well, we need a list, right? We need some verifiable list that is the best possible. And the DNR is the one who has the best resources available to do that. So if local units of government think that their parking spaces or their boat launches are wrong, then they can go to the DNR in order to have that list updated.
Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cummings, so what kind of verification has there been done either by the department or by the DNR that these funds are being used appropriately? What kind of checked process do we have in place?
Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, under current law, they say that they need a plan submitted to the Department of Natural Resources, I believe, for the aquatic invasive species, but there's no requirements in terms of what is needed in the plan. And then they're also, one of the things that Mr. Gustafson is about to talk about is trying to make sure that we at least can have the requirement that a plan is submitted so that there is a plan submitted before it is done. But to your question, Representative Anderson, there are no specifications for what those reports look like.
Chair Anderson.
Chair, Mr. Cummings, so what you're saying is we don't even know if they're submitting the plans at this point. Is that correct?
Mr. Cummings.
We do know if they are submitting the plans. What we're trying to do in this piece of legislation is to just make sure that we're clarifying who those plans are submitted by and what date, and then also making sure that there's a verification process between the DNR and DOR to ensure we know which plans have been put in or not. Some of that was not clearly specified in statute, and we just want some clarity as it relates to that.
And Mr. Chair
Anderson?
So Mr. Cummins, so there are cases where there some plans have not been submitted, is that correct?
Mr. Cummins?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I believe the answer to that question is yes.
Chair Anderson. Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Cummings, so each of these sections 27 and 29, I mean, you are creating new processes and new duties. How many new FTEs do we need for sections 27 and 29?
Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski and members, as part of this bill, there are no fiscal costs and there is no revenue impact. So these are, in terms of the verification of the forest management plans and then the aquatic invasive species aid, the verification would not require any additional FTE at the DNR or at DOR.
Chair Drazkowski.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Cummings, are you telling us that it won't take any more staff time to do sections 27 or 29?
Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair and Representative Drazkowski, in terms of if we're asked to do anything beyond the point of verifying that a plan has been submitted, if there's any sort of auditing or assessment or working with that data beyond that, we would be, obviously, we would be coming forth with trying to think about the administrative costs, and I can tell you that the DNR would as well. There are other bills traveling through the legislature related to the, I would say, anywhere from the elimination to the enhancement of these programs. We would want to be involved in those discussions, not only to make sure that they're administered the best possible, but also that the administrative impact on the DNR is assessed. The DOR and DNR is assessed. But at this point, the verification of these, we don't believe that they would require additional FTEs.
Chair Drazkowski.
So, Mr. Chair and Mr. Cummings, I know I've submitted bills that have done less than this in terms of staff time, and so have other members, and they've come back with fiscal notes. And suddenly we have a bill before us with I don't know how many different sections in it, and amazingly the fiscal note zero, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cummings, how many forest management plans are there that would be verified?
Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair, I don't know that number offhand. I can get back to you, Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Cummings, you know, I imagine we've got hundreds or thousands of forest management plans. We've got at least 87 counties for you to work with the AIS stuff. This is beyond belief, given what we've seen in the track record of fiscal notes here lately. So I would urge you to sharpen your pencil on all of these and take a closer look. Mr. Chair, one last question, if I could.
Sure.
Is Mr. Cummings, the Aquatic Invasive Species Program aid, as you know, and I think you and I may have discussed, I've discussed with others, many of our counties, this was put into the tax bill, as I understand, in the dark of night while no one was watching in the conference committee here last year. And we have committees that, or we have counties that suddenly, as dawn broke the next day, received a check in the mail, and they didn't know what to do with the money or where it came from. I suggested to them, given as I read the criteria around how this money is distributed to them, even in parts of the state where they don't have any AIS concerns that I'm aware of, including where I live, I suggested to them they might want to start building boat ramps and parking spots. And so I'm curious, have you seen an increase in the number of boat ramps and parking spots, any fresh pavement out there on the trail?
Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, I first wanted to say that as it relates to Section 29, there was administrative costs in last year's bill. Part of that was for the DNR to verify to the Department of Revenue those spots. This is just clarifying that in statute. As it relates to the question about how the money is being used for aquatic invasive species, I can't speak to that, Mr. Chair. I have not personally looked through the plans that have been submitted for aquatic invasive species aid.
Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Cummings.
Chair Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, it sounds like this aquatic invasive species might be a little controversial for
your side of the aisle, so maybe it's coming out of this bill. But, you know, Mr. Chair, just a thought, and this was not passed in the dark of the night. In fact, people like to say that this was a bill introduced in the Senate, heard in the Senate in two committees, and came through the Senate tax bill, and it took public testimony in the conference committee on it. And just for members who are new, when one body passes a bill and the other doesn't, that doesn't mean it was done in the dark of the night. So I'm sure Chair Davids is going to have items in his omnibus tax bill that won't be in the Senate tax bill, and that doesn't mean they came in the dark of the night. That just means one body thought they were a good idea and the other didn't. But so just to correct the record on that. But you know, I was listening to Representative Anderson's comments about the plan, and you know, Mr. Chair, if you make any changes to aquatic invasive species aid, I think you know perfectly well that your counterpart is going to be very interested in that. As you know, Senator Squad is very important to him, and it was his probably key initiative, one of a few for the year. So you'll spend time on that. But I think, you know, Senator or Representative Anderson raises a good point. I mean, maybe she's looking at it a little different than I am. But I would consider talking to Senator Skoy about getting rid of a plan, period. This idea of did they file them or not. You know, we don't make anyone do a plan for local government aid or fiscal disparities aid or county program aid or disparity aid or border city aid. There's no plans to receive those monies. And this does seem a little odd that Senator Skoy initially even put in a plan. So we might want to make it easier for the recipients of the aid to not even have to file a plan, because we really don't do that in all the other aid programs we have that are much larger. You're just a recipient where you certify your need based on your tax base. In this case, I think it is appropriate that someone has to know about the docs, et cetera. And I think it would be nice, as the department is bringing forward, that we have a way to know for, like I take my city, we have, you know, it's not just a northern issue or a southern issue. We have lots of docks and lots of lakes in Bloomington. And I'd like to check that, you know, Bloomington is getting the aid it's supposed to get based on the parking spaces and the amount of docks we have. And I think our cities don't have a way to ascertain that information. So I think the department's right on that one. I hope you will consider, Mr. Chair, going forward, and because we're talking about this so much, probably isn't a technical bill now, thinking about if a plan is necessary, because the rest of the aid programs we have across the state don't require a plan. So thank you.
Thank you. And generally, a lot of this stuff is done in conference committee in the dark of night in a smoke-filled room with high-priced lobbyists. But in this case, that was not the case, just so you know. Chair Drazkowski, and then Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair, a point may be well taken, but it was certainly in the dark of the House without even the knowledge of a mouse.
Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Lencheski, when I was looking at this, I think maybe we need to evaluate how we provide aid. And this was something that was for a very specific purpose, and yet we have no way of knowing if those dollars were used in that way. And I think a lot of people that are concerned about aquatic invasive species want to know that tax dollars are being used effectively to address a very serious problem for our state. So I've reached out to our Environment Finance Committee Administrator to give a heads up on this. You know, I'm sure that Representative McNamara has probably already delved into this issue, but I think it begs the question of what kind of oversight do we provide and what kind of guarantee are we giving to the taxpayers that their tax dollars are being used for the intended purpose that we set out here at the legislature.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. I have Torkelson and Earhart, Representative Torkelson. Chair Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just think it might be important to clarify what happens to funds that counties do not receive. If they choose not to receive them or do not submit a plan, what then happens to those excess funds? If Mr. Cummings would care to clarify, or someone else from the department.
Were there any counties that did not submit a plan? And if so, what happened to those funds that were not expended?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, one of the things that, we're trying to clarify in this bill, and let me be clear, Mr. Chair, we're not here to endorse or promote or eliminate or degrade any of this. We're just trying to make it work. And so as it relates to part of this is trying to create a process in which we can receive some certification of what is happening. If a county does not submit a plan, they still will receive the aid. We are, as part of our correction, we're just trying to make sure that it's clarified in statute that that a plan must be submitted before the aid is given out. The second thing we're trying to do, you know, and we believe that under current law that that the aid would go back to the general fund if a county does not submit a plan under the proposal.
Chair Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was what I wanted to clarify.
Chair Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I actually was a co-author on that bill. It came up like all our bills, and I put my name on it. So it wasn't in the dark at night. It was just when you were sleeping. That'd be the only reason.
Thank you, Chair Earhart. Okay, please continue, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Section 30 provides that requirement that Mr. Cummings alluded to, the requirement that the Commissioner of Natural Resources certify to the Commissioner of Revenue the counties that actually have complied with the requirements of establishing guidelines for addressing aquatic invasive species. Section 31 clarifies that the 5-day rescission period for sales made by contract for deed does not apply to the sales of tax forfeited property. Section 32 addresses the supplemental ag credit payments from last session, and it provides a 2-year period after which the credit lapses if the recipient does not cash the warrant that was issued or if the department is not able to locate a qualifying taxpayer. However, in the next article, Article 4, Section 6, there is a provision for the Commissioner to reissue a lapsed warrant up to 5 years after the original warrant was issued if a recipient is able to establish good cause, a reasonable cause for why the warrant was not cashed.
Okay, so that's Article 3.
There's one more provision, Mr. Chair,
okay.
In Article 3. I just wanted to mention that it's a very similar provision that pops up in Article 4, or a related provision in Article 4. The last section in Article 3, though, is Section 33, and this repeals the obsolete formulas used for calculating the SFIA payments. Those payments are now set at a flat $7 per acre rate, and so the formulas used to calculate it are no longer needed.
Okay, Chair Earhart.
Yes, I'd like to ask a question, Mr. Chairman. On page 12, we have Section 9, Sub 6. What is changing on that? I thought that was always the case. The reassessment orders.
Mr. Gustafson?
Mr. Chair, Representative, currently the State Board of Equalization does not have this authority.
Well, Mr. Chairman, unless it was taken out, it was in effect because I had properties reassessed under an order from the State Equalization Board. So was it lost for a while and now it's back or what?
Mr. Gustafson?
Mr. Chair, Representative, this is one of the issues that comes up with the commissioner wearing both hats of both acting as the commissioner in certain instances and then also acting as the State Board of Equalization. And so the commissioner would have, under current law, this type of authority, but when acting as the State Board of Equalization, currently the State Board of Equalization does not have this authority.
Chair Earhart. Okay, any other questions from anyone in the audience supporting Article 3 or provisions in Article 3 or with concerns? Any other questions from members? Thank you, Mr. Gustafson. Let's go to Article 4. And members, you can see the clock as well as I can. We'll just continue to work on this. If we don't get through, we'll pick it up Tuesday. So for those that wish to testify, you're not going to be cut short on testimony from the chamber and other entities that want to talk about this. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
My name is Cecilia Morrow. I'm an attorney for the Minnesota Department of Revenue.
Can you please spell your last name?
Morrow, M-O-R-R-O-W.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'll be summarizing Article 4, which makes changes in seven miscellaneous areas of tax administration. First, a group of sections including sections 1, 3, 12 through 19, 21 through 23, 25, 27 through 29, 32 through 37, 39 and 41. All those sections work together to provide a uniform statement of the commissioner's authority to prescribe how returns and forms are filed. Section 3 provides the basic statement to clarify that the commissioner may prescribe the content, format, and manner of returns and forms. From the amendment to the bill at line 1.3, Section 3 is amended to specify to state that any other law governing the content, format, and manner control. So it's your standard except as otherwise provided language. The other sections that I listed are amended to cross-reference the central statement of authority in Section 270C30 and Section 3. Section 21, again, is amended by the amendment on lines 1.4 to 1.5 to specify that the commissioner is not authorized by these general powers to require the electronic filing by individual income tax filers. Sections 1.12 through 15 and 19 are also amended to cross-reference the existing common definition of electronic signature that's provided in the General Tax Administration Statute, Chapter 270C. All of these changes are effective the day following final enactment. Next, Section 2 amends the statutes to expand the existing authority to allow the Commissioner of Revenue to also provide information to the Commissioner of Human Services to verify eligibility under the Medical Assistance Program. This section is effective the day following final enactment. Next, there's another group of sections, including sections 4, 5, 7, 10, 11, 24, 26, 30, 31, 38, 40, 42, and 43. All of those sections work together to make the appeal period consistent for appeals of orders of the Commissioner of Revenue, whether the taxpayer wants to go to tax court or to pursue an administrative appeal to the Department of Revenue. Court decisions in 2013 and 2014 made those appeal periods separate and made them different. They've always been separate, but the court decisions made the periods of time different. Section 7, 10, and 11 make the primary changes by amending the tax court statute in Section 10 to match the language of the administrative appeal statute that's presented in Section 7. Section 11, again, which is a tax court statute, is amended to assure that it is only the date stated on the order that the taxpayer needs to look to figure out how long they have to appeal. As amended, both statutes give the taxpayer 60 days from the date designated by the commissioner on the order as the notice date from which to appeal. All the other sections that are amended are to clarify and conform the period of time to appeal to this 60 days from the notice date that's now created consistently. These changes, again, are effective for orders and notices dated after September 30, 2015. Section 6 was already addressed by Mr. Gustafson regarding the supplemental agricultural warrant. Next, Section 8 amends the statutes to establish the statute of limitations to assess an administrative penalty against a return preparer for an improper return, that statute of limitations equals the amount of time that the department would otherwise have to assess tax on the return. The section also establishes a five-year statute of limitations for imposing a penalty arising from violations of the statute that isn't related to a specific tax return. This is effective for tax preparation services provided after the day following final enactment. Next, Section 9 amends the statutes to extend from 90 days to 3 years the period of time in which the name of a tax preparer who's been subject to a penalty, civil or criminal, for improper return preparation is posted by the department. Again, this is effective the day following final enactment. Finally, skipping to Section 20, this amends the statute to clarify that the deed tax for a conveyance of tax-forfeited land for a school forest is $1.65. And again, that's effective the day following final enactment. That's the end of Article 4 and the end of House File 1589.
Thank you very much. Anyone from the audience wish to testify regarding this article? In support of or with concerns thereof? Questions from members? Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm interested in Section 2. I'm working on a bill that would allow an outside company to conduct an income verification audit, eligibility verification audit, which would include income verification. Can you tell us, and I suspect this bill is going to go to civil law, to Mr. Chair, or no?
No. What's happening, and at the beginning of the committee was described that, Mr. Cummings described that there are several bills out there taking these various provisions to the various committees, and they're all going to end up here.
Okay.
So that this, as it is, doesn't go there. Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So how does this change in language in the authority to share information between the two agencies, how, if there was an external eligibility audit, how would that be affected by this change?
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Morrow, and what was your first name again?
For Cecilia. The
Cecilia. Cecilia?
C-E-C-I-L-I-A.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Morrow.
I'm going to refer this question to my colleague, Jacob Smith, who is our disclosure person and familiar with those matters.
Please state your name and who represents the record, please.
My name is Jacob Smith. I'm an attorney for the Minnesota Department of Revenue. And if I could ask you to
Chair Drazkowski,
your question, please.
I will, Mr. Smith. Thank you. So, Mr. Smith, under Section 2 of the bill, how does this change in language affect or is this change in language adequate to allow for an outside entity to do an eligibility verification audit on the nearly $10 billion of Medicaid spending the state does every year?
Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, all Section 2 does is expand existing authority under Chapter 270B to provide information, return information, which is sensitive classified information to the Department of Human Services. The Department of Revenue needs specific authorization under statute to provide information outside of the department. This is really a localized change that would only authorize sharing information with Human Services.
Mr. Drazkowski.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Smith, are you aware of any other language elsewhere in statute that would allow something like that or no?
Mr. Smith?
Mr. Chair, Representative, throughout Chapter 270B, there are other provisions that allow the Department of Revenue to share information, but they're specifically tailored to those agencies or individuals. So, for example, this provision, Section 2, authorizes sharing data to another agency for non-tax purposes. There are other agencies within the state that have similar authorization for other programs.
Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Smith.
Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair, just to give the contours, this is usually the authorization is done, and then there is a specific interagency agreement in which the department will enter into. Typically, these are not, we're not giving any type of return information out. Typically, what will happen is DHS will send us information with an identification number and an income, and then there is sort of a verification of whether that sort of matches what we have. So I just wanted to be clear that, you know, that is the type of data match that would go on, you know, so just to be, what are those interagency agreements would look like after this is authorized?
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Mr. Cummings, on the illegal gaming filing returns, you would have to file a return to pay a tax. Should people that are engaging in illegal gaming also file returns if they have losses? And would they be able to deduct that? And you can't tell anybody? Mr. Cummings?
You know, Mr. Chair, I think that's a good question, and we'll get back to you.
We'll talk about it. I think, members, I don't see any more questions. Oh, we do have Representative Loon and Earhart. Representative Loon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a question on Article 4, Section 3, with regards to, in reading the explanation, making the commissioner's authority sort of uniform and prescribing forms and their format. Just a question on that. If I'm reading it correctly, it says, and this looks like current law, may furnish them subject to charge on application. Do we charge taxpayers for the cost of forms or when they have to file something with the department?
Ms. Morrow?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, no.
Chair Loon?
Thank you. And so I'm just curious on why is the authority there to do so if the department made that change under, if I'm reading that section correctly, or is what is the reference to charge about?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I believe that's a very old section of statute, perhaps dating back 50, 60 years at least. And I think that there, it probably covers the circumstance of if there was significant documentation and that sort of thing. So I'm not familiar with it. Our information currently is that there aren't any that we're charging for.
Chair Loon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just, you know, maybe a comment, if that's an old section of law, maybe we'd want to look at cleaning that up as well, if there would be no intent to charge for sort of the kind of traditional or usual filing of some kind of tax forms. But just a comment, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Loon. Chair Earhart?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if the state is, since we have all this star power, is receiving any benefit from the clawback with the Peters case, the Petters case, as the case may be. Are we reaping any money from that, or is this costing us money to follow, or what?
Mr. Cummings? I believe on the issue of the clawback from charities, we passed a bill, the governor signed into law, last year, 2 years ago, that did not allow them to do that any further. But I think your question is broader. Mr. Cummings?
Mr. Chair, I don't know the answer to that question, Mr. Chair, but I can ask.
Can you get back to Chair Hart on that?
And Mr. Chairman, the only thing I would say is I have done work with circumstances of taxpayers who've been victims of Ponzi schemes, and so the department is administering those income tax statutes consistent with the federal provisions, which they primarily are issues of individual income tax or other tax, but under our system are driven by federal taxable income.
Chair Hart?
Thank you.
Okay, with that, members, that was the most exciting policy and technical bill I've had in my history here. Very interesting. So that being said, we will continue this on Tuesday so that we can get testimony from interested parties. We don't want to cut anybody off. So with that, don't stop believing. Good govern all the time.